Alrighty, so it was crazy. I went back there, I was changing my shirt, and then I started having this sneezing fit, man. And I'm like, we'll see. I don't know. I might bust out before this morning's over again, so I'm not sure. But it's good to be back with you now as we kind of go into the stuff of the day. And if you've been with us for the last couple weeks, we've been kind of in this little micro component of this larger sermon that Jesus preached to the masses. And we've been talking about this idea of what makes for the good life, right? What are those traits, those temperaments, those things that will really cause you to go, man, I'm hashtag blessed, right? This is the blessing of life. This is the best life I can live, best life here and now. Like, what does that look like? And so we've been investigating that a little bit. And as I was thinking about more this week, I thought, man, I'm curious other places where we might consider this, right? Because you have those questions sometimes. You're sitting there watching TV or something, and something clicks in your mind, and you're like, man, I should look that up really quick, because now we have an entire global library just right in our pocket. We can look stuff up, and we can ask even deeper questions today, because we have a deep thought mechanism now in our world, Copilot, AI. We've got ChatGPT. So you can go there and ask questions. And so in light of this idea of blessing, I was thinking, like, yeah, what's it going to tell me when it comes to the blessed, good life? And so the first question I asked it was just like, hey, what do Americans consider to be like the blessed life? Or what would be the things that would contribute to a sense of blessing for life? And so this was the list I was given right here. So strong relationships, good health, financial security, meaningful work, personal growth, community engagement, leisure and hobbies, freedom and independence, spirituality and faith. And I actually looked at that list and I thought, man, that's pretty solid. I think if I was to ask most of us at any given time, we would probably have a good chunk of those things in the list. And there's some stuff in that list where I go, get it. I want that too. That would cause me to say, I'm blessed in life. So then I thought about it more and I thought, well, I wonder what would the answer be to the idea of when it comes to Christians. Like if Christians were thinking like, how does God bless us? What are the things that I need to do as a Christian to be blessed by God? So I was given this list next. Faith in Jesus Christ, prayer, reading the Bible, obedience, attending church, loving others, service, charity, and repentance. And I thought, ChatGPT, AI, it's a good theologian, actually. Like, I don't know if you've ever hopped on there. It actually gives really good advice. I got on there one day and just started asking, like, marriage advice and parenting advice. It actually has some decent thoughts. It's shocking. But then I look at these lists, and again, while I see some commonality between community and spirituality and that kind of thing, I couldn't help but think, but then what does Jesus say is the blessed life? Like, what is the way that we can most bless others, and what is the way we can be most blessed as we do these different things? And yet, when we look at Jesus' list, it's just going to look different than these other lists. It's not going to look in the way that we would do things or put things together, because he says to be blessed and to be a blessing is rooted in very distinct things. The Beatitudes that we've been looking at. And so you look at that list, and the first six that we've looked into are things like poverty of spirit, mourning, meekness, craving justice for others, mercy, and purity of heart. Now I look at that list, and quite frankly, some of the things in that list, I could actually say, like, in relationship to the other two things, like, that makes perfect sense. I mean, if I look at that, I go, yeah, man, like, mercy, I'm blessed when people are merciful to me. I feel a blessing when I'm merciful to others. Purity of heart, yeah, I can get that too. That makes sense. Now, where it gets a little murky is, like, craving justice for others, because then it's like, well, what do we mean by that? What does that look like? And everything else. But then other parts of the list, you kind of go, like, meh. Is that really the blessed life? Is that the good life? Because I rarely ever have a season of mourning and go, man, I'm so blessed, crying every day, right? Like I don't feel that. Or poverty of spirit, like I get it, like, oh yeah, I want to be humble inside. But that, even that is like, is that really what's going to fill my bucket, make me feel most alive? When you read it in Luke's gospel, he's just straight up. He's just like, blessed are the poor, or blessed are the poor, and woe to the rich. He even puts it in like monetary terms. And you go, like, that wouldn't make me feel blessed. Meekness? Yeah, like you can read some of those that are in that murky area and be like, well, they would be blessed, but it would be kind of like upside down-ish from the world, backwards-ish from the way that we typically see things. But then Jesus isn't done. He's like, well, I got three final things that are going to make you feel blessed. They're going to make you be a blessing. And those three things, peacemaking, sure. But then what's he say? Persecution for doing what's right, and having gladness in persecution for his sake. I don't know if any of us go like, that's the blessed life. Especially those last two. To my knowledge, there are no Hallmark cards for this one. Right? Hey, congratulations, you got your butt kicked in the dirt. Crack a smile without a tooth through that fat lip face. Like, it's not there. We would not put this in the category. I looked at the card section at Safeway. It's not existent. I want to find it. It's not there. Jesus' blessing is different than our blessing. But that's exactly where we're going to go today. The last three Beatitudes that I believe are the toughest and I believe the most critical in some ways. Like, if we can do this and live this and master this and want this and crave this, man, that's where healing for the world begins to come. When people are willing to lean into that and actually believe that that is the route to blessing. And so we're going to square all of this up today by looking into those things. But as we do that, I want to remind you that in the app that are notes, there is a podcast for this next week from the Bible Project, some things you can fill on in the blanks as well, just so you can kind of anchor this stuff more, because that's what we're talking about. I don't want this to be like, hey, that was an insightful, interesting sermon or whatever else. I want it to be something where we're like, man, I want to do this. I want to live this. I want to be this. And so let me go ahead and pray for us right now as we get ready. Jesus, I come before you right now, and I admit that there is stuff that is packed into this that I love it on paper. I do. I love it on paper. I go, I'm inspired by that. Oh, that moves me. But do I want to do it? Do I want to take the homework and put it into practice? That's the challenge before all of us. And I admit there are days that I'm eager, and there's other days that I go, you don't know my circumstance, and I don't want to do this today. And I'm asking you to work that out in us, not so much that we feel like trash at the end, but rather that we feel reinvigorated to remember why we started following you. That we started following you because you are so beautiful in a world that can be so ugly, and you are so compelling in a world that can be so cruel, and that you are inviting us to partner with you, and that we would want to be in that partnership, even though we take loss and we might suffer and it might be hard. But if we do it your way with your Spirit, you will use that to bring transformation to other people's lives, so that, again, down the road, we see other people being baptized because they love you and they want to follow you and they want to be different for you. And so help us to be in that space and do those things. And so, Jesus, we look to you and we need you and we love you in your good name. Amen. All right, so Jesus rolls in on the scene, and he's not simply God's guy, he's God the guy, right? So he's not just another prophet, another teacher, another person that's trying to bring a new thing. He is God himself showing up, and he's like, I want you to face the world differently. I don't want you to think like the way it was done in the past. I don't want you to use the same tools or mechanisms that you are used to. He's like, man, I'm trying to do a new thing by creating a new kind of people who think different so that they can bring a new kind of transformation to the world. And so with that, we saw back in Matthew chapter 4, just before the sermon gets underway, he has his clarion call, right? Think different. I mean, I'm going to probably say this a lot through the series because, again, I think we hear that word repent and we kind of moralize it and we fail to realize that really the word repent is just saying, you got to turn around, man. You got to think about doing life and reacting and responding to things in a way that's not normal to you. That's think different, which is hard because we get well-trained in reactivity. We get well-trained in our amygdala talking, you know, to the adrenal glands and reacting in things of life. And we get well-equipped in maybe wrong responses. And so Jesus needs us to think different. And then with that, he wants us to believe, not just believe in, but really believe with conviction that there's this good news. It's light breaking into the darkness. It's life kind of pushing back death. And he's bringing this idea of the skies to confront the stuff of the land. It's so upside down. It's so backwards. It's so different. And so with that, then he ascends a mountain. He sits in the dirt. And he begins to articulate what is the longest recorded sermon of his in all of the scriptures. Longest. For us, it's three chapters, chapter 5, chapter 6, chapter 7. And he starts in this place of blessing. Like, he wants to front load us to say, if you do it this way, not only is he going to bless you, but in doing these things and having these characteristics, it's going to bless the people around you. And it's going to seem really foreign. It's going to seem like it doesn't work. You're going to want to resist this or retaliate or do it different. But he's like, this is the way to enjoy in yourself and express to others God's version for a new kind of life. And so he gives it in these three packets of three. So what was the first packet? This was a couple of weeks ago. It was this idea of the Beatitudes, these nine things total, but the first three are all about the attitudes for life, right? Just these things that are to be true to our core. From there, he went into approaches to life, right? Seeking justice and mercy and having a pure heart. But then today, it's all about actions. Actions in life, like these things that we have to go and concretely do, that we have to engage in some capacity. But this is all about him making a new kind of community that can bring a new kind of vision for a new way of life to shape a new world. Like, all of that is in there. And he starts in a really interesting place for me. He starts in the place of makers. Makers. And in our world, there are a lot of makers, right? There's money makers and playmakers and history makers, troublemakers, right? Lots of makers, deal makers, newsmakers, you name it. So it's no wonder to me that Jesus goes into a place that's so critical. He goes into something that's especially needed in divided times, the most important makers on the planet. He says, blessed are the peacemakers, for they will be called children of God, right? And just that idea there, peacemakers, both halves of that word are really, really important. And so I want to start with last things first. I want to start with that tail end word of the makers, because here's what that's not saying. It's not saying, blessed are the peace keepers. Like, it'd be an interesting thing, or maybe an easy thing to fall into and say, that's all he's really looking for, right? The peace keepers. But here's the thing about if you put keepers on the end. Oftentimes, what a peacekeeper is like a conflict avoider. So it's like, let's just pretend it's not there. Let's just turn our backs to it, act like there's nothing, right? Or maybe it's an issue neglecter or a problem denier. Right? So it's not looking honestly at what's before us. It's just saying, you know what, if we just pretend like it's not there, if we just bury our heads in the sand, whatever it is, it might go away. The problem with the peacekeeper is it actually brings forth the inevitable. The more you just try to be the peacekeeper in a marriage, with your kids, at work, in life, whatever it is, it's just allowing things to swell. Right? Nobody's trying to bring stop or restoration or health. You're just hoping, like, maybe the fire will burn itself out eventually. Maybe it'll all go away. Maybe everybody will just reset internally and it's gonna be fine. And sometimes that can happen. But for the most part, when there's this spirit of, like, I'm just gonna be the peacekeeper, it kind of ends up being this passive catalyst to kind of, like, just churning up more chaos. That's the risk and the danger behind it. And so Jesus isn't inviting us to keep peace. No, he's saying, I want you to be constructors, creators, curators, makers, right? Of this idea of an effective way of bringing peace to conflict. So there's nothing about it that's passive. There's nothing about, like, our hands are in our pockets or behind our back or whatever else. There's this sense of, like, no, you move to the challenge. You see the crisis point, and then you're trying to figure out, in the wisdom of God and the grace of God and the sensitivity of God, how do I put myself in that space and bring something positive where there is something negative? That's this essence of the peacemakers. And so to understand Jesus' version, because we're going to have our own versions of peace, I want us to understand his version and his world in his way. So let's go ahead and watch this little clip right now.
The word peace is common in most languages. People can talk about peace treaties or times of peace. It means the absence of war. And in the Bible, the word peace can refer to the absence of conflict, but it also points to the presence of something better in its place. In the Old Testament, the Hebrew word for peace is shalom. And in the New Testament, the Greek word is eirene. The most basic meaning of shalom is complete or whole. The word can refer to a stone that has a perfect, whole shape with no cracks. It can also refer to a completed stone wall that has no gaps and no missing bricks. Shalom refers to something that's complex with lots of pieces that's in a state of completeness, wholeness. It's like Job, who says his tents are in a state of shalom because he counted his flock and no animals are missing. This is why shalom can refer to a person's well-being. Like when David visited his brothers on the battlefield, he asked about their shalom. The core idea is that life is complex, full of moving parts and relationships and situations, and when any of these is out of alignment or missing, your shalom breaks down. Life is no longer whole, it needs to be restored. In fact, that's the basic meaning of shalom when you use it as a verb. To bring shalom literally means to make complete or restore. So Solomon brings shalom to the unfinished temple when he completes it. Or if your animal accidentally damages your neighbor's field, you shalom them by giving them a complete repayment for their loss. You take what's missing and you restore it to wholeness. The same goes for human relationships. In the book of Proverbs, to reconcile and heal a broken relationship is to bring shalom. And when rival kingdoms make shalom in the Bible, it doesn't just mean they stop fighting, it also means they start working together for each other's benefit. This state of shalom is what Israel's kings were supposed to cultivate, and it rarely happened. So the prophet Isaiah, he looked forward to a future king, a prince of shalom, and his reign would bring shalom with no end. A time when God would make a covenant of shalom with his people and make right all wrongs and heal all that's been broken. This is why Jesus' birth in the New Testament was announced as the arrival of Eirene. Remember, that's the Greek word for peace. Jesus came to offer his peace to others, like when he said to his followers, "My peace I give to you all." The apostles claimed that Jesus made peace between messed up humans and God when he died and rose from the dead. The idea is that he restored to wholeness the broken relationship between humans and their creator. This is why the Apostle Paul can say Jesus himself is our Eirene. He was the whole complete human that I am made to be but have failed to be. And now he gives me his life as a gift. And this means that Jesus' followers are now called to create peace. Paul instructed local churches to keep their unity through the bond of peace, which requires humility and patience and bearing with others in love. Becoming people of peace means participating in the life of Jesus, who reconciled all things in heaven on earth, restoring peace through his death and resurrection. So peace takes a lot of work, because it's not just the absence of conflict. True peace requires taking what's broken and restoring it to wholeness, whether it's in our lives, our relationships, or in our world. And that's the rich biblical concept of peace.
So it gives us some perspective, and I think it's helpful because when Jesus says this in his world, just as much as he says it in our world, we find that peace kind of falls into the eye of the beholder a little bit. Like, each person, they might look at this word a little from a different point of view or apply it in different kinds of ways. And so even as Jesus is saying this, there's going to be some like the Essenes, right? The ones that are out in the desert, they're removed from everybody. And they'd say, well, peace is escapism. Peace is just not getting involved. Peace is just reestablishing your own thing away from all of the problems. Rome would say, no, peace comes through law and through policing and through security. And so they had the peace of Rome, literally at the end of a Roman sword. They would say that's how peace is defined. The zealots of Jesus' day that wanted to fight Rome, they'd say, no, warfare is the key to peace. You have to destroy your enemy, and then from that you gain peace because it's now things under your control. And so it's always been this debate, right? This what really constitutes peace? How do you get there? What does it look like? What does it mean to maintain it? And so I'd say peace kind of comes on a spectrum. We have words for it. In fact, I put this together this week for us a little bit, this idea of a spectrum, right? And it just kind of runs across. For example, the first is just chillness. You want to have peace? Be chill. That's it. Don't get all worked up. Don't be the source of the friction. Just be chill. If somebody has friction with you and it isn't really bugging you, be chill. It's kind of great peace right there. Next, though, is forgiveness. Like, if you want real peace, it's going to mean one of two things. Either you did something wrong and you have to seek it, or somebody did something wrong to you and you still got to seek it, right? In other words, Jesus is going to get into this in a little while later in the Sermon on the Mount, where he's going to be like, hey, man, you know somebody's got something against you. You've done something against one another. You got to go to that person. You got to be reconciled so you can have peace. So sometimes it's just, man, if you want to get to that space, forgiveness has got to be the key. The third is negotiation. In other words, there's real problems, real crises, whatever, and yet you're going not to win, not to fight. You're going to discuss. You're going to negotiate. You're trying to figure out, how do we come to middle? That's a way that peace can be forged. Another is boundary. And as a church, we've talked about boundaries a number of times, that you go, I just... we can't get it now, so we're going to have boundary for now, and then maybe down the road, things can come together. But that's a way to have peace, too, at least for a season. You're like, man, we don't want to keep the conflict going. Now, part of that is not setting a boundary out of bitterness. You're not trying to punish the other party. It's not that. You just go like, hey, man, this is the way for peace right now, and then maybe in time we can come back around to it differently. Maybe I'll heal up more inside, whatever it is, and we can go through the process of negotiation back to forgiveness, and then we're just chill together, right? It's like that. But then you also have this idea of intimidation. Intimidation is what governments use. Sometimes intimidation is what parents use or spouses use to one another. Where now we're getting into this other darker thing. And really at the core of that, that's not going to be so much about peace. It's going to be about trying to force compliance, right? Like a type of kind of emotional surrender. So I'm just going to intimidate you into right action, right behavior, right perspective, whatever it is. And then the final extreme is force. Force is what nations use, right? We see conflicts around the world, and all of that is saying we're going to get to peace by out-bombing you, out-shooting you, out-killing you, out crushing your economy, whatever it is. And so there are all sorts of philosophies and theories on how you get to peace. Surrender, compliance, all the way through to the healthiest thing of chill. But what's Jesus getting at here? That's the question. I read a quote this week from a guy named Scott McKnight, and I thought it was so good. He says, peacemaking, here it is neither being nice nor is it tolerance. Instead, it is an active entrance into the middle of warring parties for the purpose of creating reconciliation and peace. But then he goes a step deeper. He says, in this, however, there is the recognition that differences between parties are not always identical. There is a difference between the parties who have experienced discrimination and those who have inflicted discrimination, between those who split a church and those who choose to remain. He picks it up. He says, between husbands and wives who are struggling to get along, between colleagues at the office, between parents and children who can't seem to find enough common ground to trust one another. Those are all the different variations. Sometimes there's a right side and a wrong side, a good guy and a bad guy, and you still have to enter in. Sometimes it's just confusion and difference. You got to enter in. He says, the peacemaker, as the person that Jesus blesses, seeks to reconcile, not by pretending that there are no differences or by suppressing the differences, but, and here's the key, by creating love of the other that transcends those differences or that permits the people to join hands despite their differences. Jesus is framing moral relations here in terms of love and servanthood. Those are the foundations of peacemaking. Right? So again, peacemaking isn't just pretending like there's not a problem, and it's not saying I don't identify a right and a wrong here, but you still have to get into this space. So if I took our model here and I said where I think Jesus is at, it's more in that range there. Right? I think that's the space he's in. Like, chill, great. Forgive, absolutely. Jesus is way too clear about how we're supposed to deal with forgiveness, right? Like, it's in there. And certainly there was tension even among early Christians. They needed to have this sense of negotiation, discussion, working to center. Read Acts 15. Those people are like debating about, man, how do we handle this whole new gospel to the Gentiles? It's there, but they had to work toward peace in that. And I would even say boundary is something that Jesus encourages. We're going to see it in Matthew chapter 7 when we get toward the end of the Sermon on the Mount. So it's all there, right? But that's where we're not to be. And that far end, we're supposed to be in that more mid-range. And I would say if there's a heart behind it or a spirit behind it, and this is one that's hard for me, so I'm not like, sometimes people hear me like, well, easy for you to say. I'm like, you're right, because I'm saying it. I'm not having to do it, right? Like, it's hard to do this stuff, but I would say the spirit of this whole thing, trying to be a peacemaker, is that you are coming into it not having to be right, but you're seeking to do right by God and others. Like, if the goal is, it only is going to be peace if I'm seen as right in the end, we may not get there always. But if our goal is, like, I want to do right by others, I want to do right by God, I want to do right by my neighbor, right by my enemy, whatever it is, that's the place that Jesus takes us, because that's the essence of righteousness. We learned this last week, that righteousness is right by othersness, right by Godness. I'm making words up now. But that's what it is. That's the essence and the heart behind it. In fact, Jesus' little brother gets into this. Which I still always just think, like, man, what a drag to have Jesus as your big brother. Like, there's no way. Like, your friend's like, why can't you be like your big brother? Because he's God. I can't do that. So, but his little brother writes a letter later, and he's really just unpacking his big brother's teaching. Like, James is five chapters of a lot of Jesus, just reiterated to the new problems. And in the book of James, it's cool. He's writing to all these different Christians. They're all scattered because of persecution of some kind, and they're starting to fight with themselves. The rich and the poor are fighting, and power tripping people are fighting, and everybody else. And so he steps into this, and he begins to speak like, hey, here's how you're a peacemaker in the middle of conflict. He says it starts with wisdom. He says the wisdom from above is first of all pure, and then it's peace-loving, not just peace-tolerating, or, oh, sure, I'll do peace. It loves the idea of peace. It's gentle at all times and willing to yield to others. It is full of mercy and the fruit of good deeds. It shows no favoritism, and it's always sincere. And those who are peacemakers will plant seeds of peace and reap a harvest of righteousness, right? So he has this great statement, and then immediately what's he say? What is causing the quarrels and fights among you? You know what the answer to that is? Failure to do what we just read. He's like, the reason there's fights, the reason there's quarrels, because you know what? You're not willing to forgive. You're not willing to negotiate. You're not willing to maybe set healthy boundaries. It's not about purity and loving of peace and gentleness and mercy and good deeds and impartiality and sincerity. It's not wanting to do right by others, right? It's not those things. He says, so it's going to cause a lot of friction, a lot of suffering, a lot of pain. And so you see the churches that he's writing to, they were in that space. Everybody was just contending for themselves and not contending for Jesus's best among them. And so he's reminding, remember what my brother said? Man, you're going to be blessed if you're peacemakers. It's going to fill up your bucket, right? Now, when it comes to the art of peacemaking, whether that's between parties or when we're wronged or when we've wronged others, because I'll tell you what, that's the hardest time to be a peacemaker. It's easy to get in when other people are fighting. It's very tough when you're like, they did me wrong, and you still have to be the peacemaker. That's hard. Or they did wrong to me, or I did wrong to them, and I got to go to them, but I know I did wrong, and I got to have some humble pie. I got to kind of eat my words a little bit. I got to stoop and ask for forgiveness. Whatever it is, man, it's hard to do. So here's what peacemaking takes. First, it takes the first six Beatitudes and the last two Beatitudes. So it's all strung together. He's like, man, if you're going to get to that place, you got to be poor in spirit. You got to have that death of ego, and you got to be sad over division, not angry over division. Like, the whole thing is in there, right? Next, you got to be patient. Can't have a lot of just like, no, it's got to be done in 5 seconds. It may not be done in 5 days or 5 weeks or whatever, but you got to have some patience in it. Selflessness, right? The goal isn't about, again, me being right. It's about us being right. Graciousness, courageousness, like being willing to enter into the whole thing. And again, a want of wholeness more than rightness. I think that's why Jesus starts off with the first beatitude being the death of ego. Like, we're never going to get there. If we don't get number one figured out, and then two, then three, then four, then five, then six, number seven is going to be tough. But if we do it, he says, then we will be called children of God. And I love this, because you know all he's saying is, you're going to be a chip off the old block. We're going to be like, oh man, those guys are like, they're old man. Like, they're just like God. They're just, his kids look just like him. They're doing just like him. Which is interesting, because at the very end of Matthew chapter 5, he's going to bring this idea up again about being sons of God, children of God, offspring of God. And there, he's going to be talking about when you love your enemies, when you do good to them, you pray for them, you bless them, when you do that stuff, he's like, now you're going to be like sons of God. So Jesus does a really fascinating thing. He grounds this idea of being God's kids in relationship, right? So relationship to those who have factions and relationship to those who are a faction against you. When you love both of those spaces, he's like, those are God's kids. Undeniable, right? That's the stuff where people recognize that God is alive and active in the world, right? That's the space. And I think about that, and I think part of the reason Jesus encourages this is because this is what he did for us. Like, when you read through the Christian scriptures of the New Testament, you see this repeated theme. We were enemies, we didn't want God, but God was a peacemaker, sends Jesus to make peace for us, and he gives us his peace. And so in the same way that he does this for us, we do this in his name. We do it in his name. Now, if you go back and go, well, Jesus did this for us, and what was the net effect of him coming to make peace? He was persecuted, right? He comes to be the peace of God, to bring the peace of God, to usher in a reign of peace because he's the Prince of Peace. And what is the effect? They killed him for it. So it's no surprise that no sooner does he talk about the peacemaker that he immediately says, oh, and then also, blessed are those who are persecuted because of righteousness, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. Now, is that not dumb to you? Like, just pause for a minute. If I told you, I know this person, poor in spirit, they mourn over the brokenness of the world, they're so meek, they hunger and thirst for righteousness, they're so merciful, they have a pure heart, right? They want to make peace, and they get their butt kicked for it, you'd be like, what? Who gets their butt kicked for being a peacemaker and all those other things? I don't know, Jesus, early Christians, Martin Luther King, the Anabaptists, Gandhi, who wasn't even a Christian, still got his butt kicked for doing the Sermon on the Mount, right? Any time, like Tiananmen Square, people are peaceful protesting and they're getting run over by tanks, like, you name it. People try to do things in the name of peace and they get billy clubbed and water cannoned and arrested. It's all there. It's the weirdest thing. We go, why would that happen? That's just what happens when, basically what I think it is, especially when it comes to the Beatitudes, is when you bring all of these to bear, I bring these to bear into the world kicks back. Like the status quo is not the list that Jesus gives. It's the upside down and backwards list. And when you do that, it confronts the world, right? Like the death of ego confronts ego. Mercy confronts this sense of power and strength and just all the stuff that Jesus is saying. Like the world sees it and they're like, pow, and just jam it. So I look and I go, it's just not shocking that it happens. And it happens both from the secular world and it happens from the religious world. Who killed Jesus? Both crews. What brings everybody together? The Beatitudes, to crush it. That's what brings everybody. And so that's what happens with Jesus. Nevertheless, it's upside down and backwards. And so from that, I would say the good life of Jesus is seen in those who are willing to endure wrong for what's right. For righteousness' sake. Now, this is just quick because it's important. I want you to zero in. He says, for righteousness' sake, not for self-righteousness' sake. Right? Not for self-righteousness' sake. Because here's the thing. I see it often as a pastor. I see people basically being jerks for Jesus. And then they're like, I'm getting persecuted. I'm like, no, you're not. You're getting punished, man. It's not the same. Right? It's not the same. You say something thuggish, you say something callous, you say something cruel, you say something cold, you say something snarky, you say something self-righteous, and then the world punches you in the face. It's not persecution. It's not. It's just retribution for being a punk. That's all. In fact, Peter gets into this, and you got to remember, here's Peter. Remember Peter? He's the mouthy, impetuous, not always thinking through stuff, dude. Says stuff, gets punched in the face, can't figure out why. Well, eventually he figures it out. Like, half the time he's getting punched in the face by Jesus. Like, dude, you don't get it. Let's fix this, you know? But eventually he gets it figured out. And he's talking to these other Christians, and he's trying to get them up to speed on the difference between being punished for self-righteousness and being punished for righteousness. And so he says this in his letter years and years later. He says, God is pleased when we are conscious of his will and we patiently endure unjust treatment. He says, of course, you get no credit for being patient if you're beaten for doing wrong. Makes sense, because it's easy to do. Oh, man, I did a bunch of really cruel stuff, and now they're mad at me. He's like, well, that's on you. That's on you, dude. He says, but if you suffer for doing good and endure it patiently, whoo, that's the additive that I don't like. If you suffer for doing good, and, oh, you got to be patient. In endurance, God is pleased with you, for God has called you to do good, even if it means suffering, just as Christ suffered for you. He is your example, and you must follow in his steps. Every time I read that in Peter, I can't help but go, there's one thing that Jesus says in the whole cross scene that actually has to do with that right there, and that was when he says, forgive them, they don't know what they're doing. Like, if we go, damn them, they know what they're doing, that world, those people, that's not it. That's not, this is like, man, like Jesus is like, hey, forgive them. They don't even know what they're up to. They don't understand it, right? So if we suffer for being a punk, it's on us. But if we suffer for doing what's right by God and others, man, then we're doing the right thing. And so Peter gets into this. He says in chapter 3, He says, don't repay evil for evil. Don't retaliate with insults when people insult you. Instead, pay them back with a blessing. Who wants to do this? Looking for hands still? No, I'm kidding. No, not. I would be like, well, I'll just keep my, I'm just trying to get my money for tithing later. I don't want to raise my hand. He says, that's what God has called you to do, and he will grant you his blessing. So it's a promise. Like, I don't want to bless them, I want to curse them. He's like, no, but if you bless them, you're going to be actually paid off for that. It goes into verse 13. Who will want to harm you if you're eager to do what is good? Even if you suffer doing what is right, God will reward you for it. So, he says, don't worry or be afraid of their threats. Instead, you must worship Christ as Lord of your life. And if someone asks about the hope that you have as a believer, always be ready to explain it. But do this in a gentle and respectful way. Keep your conscience clear. Then if people speak against you, they will be ashamed for what they see when they see your good life and they remember that you belong to Christ, that you're living like Jesus. You're doing the Beatitudes, right? And then he says, remember, it is better to suffer for doing good, if that's what God wants, than to suffer for doing wrong. See, Peter right there is just explaining what Jesus means here in this beatitude, right? And while it might cost us here, God says, I'm going to reward you there on the other side of this whole thing. And so from this, Jesus then doubles down. And he says, not only are you blessed for suffering, he says, you're blessed in how you suffer. And so that's the last of the Beatitudes. The good life of Jesus is seen in those who rejoice when ridiculed. Blessed are you when people insult you and persecute you and falsely say all kinds of things or evil things against you because of me. So he's rooting it in the relationship between us and him. So he says, rejoice and be glad, because great is your reward in heaven. In fact, in Luke's gospel, he says, leap for joy. Leap for joy. Like, what's the Greek of that? Leap for joy, all right? He says, because great is your reward in heaven, for the same way they persecuted the prophets who were before you. Handful of things really fast here that's important to note. First of all, you might not have caught it, but Jesus shifts from third person, blessed generically, to second person, blessed are you. So as he ends it, he wants us to own it. Like, it's not just like, hey, blessed are all you over there. No, you, me, he's talking to me. I will be blessed if I do these things. That's the first thing. Second thing that's critical here, he talks that opposition will come in all sorts of varieties as far as the way that it comes. It's going to be verbal, or it might be emotional, or reputational, or physical. It's also going to come from a variety of sources, right? There's going to be anti-religious people that talk trash about you because they hate religion. And guess what? There's going to be religious people, Christian people, that talk trash about you because you're trying to love Jesus. There's going to be people in your family, political minds, social minds, nationalistic minds, whatever. They're going to be like, man, I'm against you because you're with him. Like, I know in my own life, you know, I've been a pastor for 30 plus years. Most of the critics of my life, people, they claim Jesus. That's just the way I'm, that's my existence. People say things, do things. That's just what's going to happen. But then Jesus is clear. He's like, here's the deal. When you're insulted or opposed or misrepresented, I want you to live a certain way. And here's, man, maybe perhaps the biggest challenge in this, right? Like, you just think about it, you go, hey, when somebody's just speaking trash about you, they're talking smack, they're working against you in some way, what are you to do? What are you allowed to do according to Jesus? Can you lash out? Can you fight back? Can you go on the defensive? Can you make demands? Hell yeah, you can. If you want to represent hell, all right? So, but if you're going like, I'm a person of the kingdom of heaven, I'm bringing the skies to the land, I don't want to unleash hell with my tongue, because that's where James says it comes from, right? James 3. Our tongues can unleash hell. And if we're in the space of when we're harmed, we want to harm, we'll unleash hell. But if we do it Jesus' way, it's going to be upside down and backwards. And the proof of that is when he says, rejoice and be glad. Fun fact, you might not have picked it up. We've looked at 9 verses, 9 Beatitudes. The only time we are ever commanded to anything in all 9 Beatitudes, right there. It's the only time the command comes up. So it's like, when I'm in this space, what do I need to do? I need to rejoice. I need to be glad. Not in spite of the circumstance, but because of the circumstance. Because of the circumstance. Like, think about that. You just got your butt kicked into the dirt for Jesus. What do?
Woohoo!
Fist bump, high fives, chest plug. I'm just, that's what we're supposed to, it's hard, I get it. But it's powerful. I think it's most powerful. I've thought about this one a lot, so you're just getting my own processing. If you're getting punked in life, and you're holding up, and you're staying gracious, and yeah, you're having to go to war within yourself, like, you know, you want all that ugly to come out, you're ready to go at it or whatever else, but you keep just kind of leaning into, like, Jesus, you want me to believe this, you want me to think different, and from that, I do different, and I act different. If you, from all of that, as you've warred within yourself, and you surrender yourself, that death of ego, and all the rest of the Beatitudes, and you get to that space, and you live that way, I think that is the most compelling thing the planet will ever see, right? It's the most compelling thing because there is something, if you watch people suffer well, it's inspiring. The people that don't suffer well, you're not inspired by that. You might go like, I get it, I do that too. But boy, the people that suffer well, that's the game changer, right? And I think that's where Jesus is driving us to in the end. He's like, you want to prove that I'm real, I'm legit, I can change the world? He says, well, in the face of wrong, do the right. Do the hard, do the beautiful and the good. Remain pure and poor and mourning and meek and hungering for justice still and peacemaking and, again, and through all of it, rejoicing and being glad. Yeah, it's upside down. Yeah, it's backwards, but it's also life-changing. So then it's no wonder to me that no sooner does Jesus sum up the Beatitudes, like this is what you're supposed to be, this is how you're supposed to function, this is how you're supposed to flourish, he immediately goes into, now I want you to go and salt the land. I want you to light the earth. I want you to be a city for a new kind of world, which is exactly where he's going to take us next week. Now that you're mobilized to be a different people, go make a difference out in the world that you're in. So for us today, I close with two questions. First question is this. What is Jesus calling you to do and go to create peace? Like, what's that space where you're like, right now I want to go create war? I want to go pick a fight? Or I want to go take sides in a fight? Or, like, where is he calling you to create peace? And it's hard. Peacemakers, it's a tough gig, man. It's a tough gig. That's why I always joke, there are no video games. People run around as like diplomats and stuff like that and trying to get countries to get along, man. And those first-person shooters, not first-person peace treaties. You know, it's super hard. But where is Jesus calling you to do that? And then next, how is Jesus asking you to suffer well, loving your opposition with a sense of rejoicing? Because we probably all have it somewhere, some way. And we're trying to figure out, am I chill, forgiving, are we interacting, are we boundarying, what are we doing, but not slipping into the things that are destructive. And so with that, I'm going to go ahead and pray for all of us right now. Jesus, we need your help every day. Like, honestly, you know, it's so weird to put together talks where you're setting a bar that you yourself will always struggle with. You're trying to inspire to action that you are inconsistent with. Like it just, it's a tough place to be. And I know all of us struggle with those things. And so we're asking for your help and guidance and your freedom and your reminder. And maybe in this too, I ask that you will give real practical, tangible tastes of the blessing that comes with that. Like that while we move in faith and hope, there would also be some experience of those blessings that you give for doing these hard things. So help us to be what you want us to be and the way you want us to do it. We love you, Jesus, and thank you in your good name. Amen.